The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Today, it's great to chat with Arthur Brooks on the podcast. Arthur is the William Henry Bloomberg Professor of the Practice of Public Leadership at the Harvard Kennedy School and Professor of Management Practice at the Harvard Business School. Before joining the Harvard faculty in July of 2019, he served for 10 years as president of the Washington, D.C.-based American Enterprise Institute, AEI, one of the world's leading think tanks. Arthur is the best-selling author of 11 books on topics ranging from economic opportunity to human happiness. His most recent bestseller, Love Your Enemies, love that title, by the way, is a guide to building a better country and mending personal relationships amidst our culture of political polarization. Arthur, I'm so glad to finally chat with you on this podcast.
Thank you, and congratulations on the phenomenal success of the Psychology Podcast. I'm an avid listener. I love it. I mean, I think it's a great podcast, and I'm obviously not alone because it's the number one psychology podcast in the world. Congratulations on that.
Well, thank you so much, Arthur. I don't know if you remember me. You probably don't. There are a lot of people in the room that day, but when you came to the Positive Psychology Center, you gave a talk about 3 years ago. I was, can I use the word smitten? I was just so impressed with the way that you're able to balance like kind of extreme views and kind of have the nuance about it.
Thanks. I appreciate that. And you know, you're a Marty guy. I mean, Marty Seligman guy. And so I've been a big fan of Marty's, and those of us who are in the kind of the Marty cosmos have a lot in common, basically trying to make people better off, trying to lift people up, trying to bring people together, and then the confidence that we can actually do so. And that's actually what I like so much about your podcast. It's not just a gee whiz kind of deal. It's in every episode, you have the science, you have the application to your life, and you have the exhortation to share the wisdom with others. And you know, that's actually the formula for getting happier. Understand, apply, and share. And you do it every day. It's great.
Thank you so much. Thank you. That means a lot. I love your podcast too. Hey, I thought I'd start off with a quote from Jonah Goldberg, who was describing your character structure. And since this is a psychology podcast, I thought this would be an appropriate place to start. Jonah Goldberg described you as, quote, a strange creature by Washington standards. Heck, a strange creature by bipedal standards. A former French horn player who decided to be an egghead late in life, he's a unique mix of Catholic piety, data obsession, sartorial connoisseurism, physical fitness, old soul wisdom, and basic decency. Now, I was wondering, how do you feel about this description of yourself?
Jonah's a good writer. That for the listeners who don't know Jonah Goldberg, he's a longtime essayist from the National Review and general public intellectual around town. Also, When he wrote that, he was my employee at the American Enterprise Institute. So anything is nice about it, we can't take it seriously.
There's some truth there, though. There's like a grain. Yeah. There are grains.
He's fantastic. And he's also a really acute sort of, he's a good commentator and he's got a great eye. And so this idea of, these salient characteristics of my personality are all knit together into this one, portrait of weirdness. I kind of like it.
I like it. Yeah. Well, I want to pull out one thing there. Horn player. Now you are like legit a musician, right? That's a part of you.
Yeah, no, that was my goal in life. So yeah. Starting when I was 9 years old, I had literally one goal in life, which was to be the world's greatest French horn player. Isn't America great? You say, I want to be the world's greatest French horn player. And it's actually not an impossible dream. So I did nothing but that. I mean, I basically slacked off in school, did nothing but play in every ensemble, every competition. I studied with the best horn players I could possibly find. My sort of lower middle class family made huge sacrifices so that I could do that. And when I went to college reluctantly when I was 18 and promptly dropped all my required courses and was invited to earn my success outside the college. And so I went pro when I was 19. I spent my entire 20s playing chamber music and symphony orchestras, winding up for a long time in the Barcelona Symphony in Spain. And then only in my late 20s did I start doing my college education. And I graduated from college a month before my 30th birthday, left the music business at 31 to start my PhD.
And tell me about your PhD topic and what department was it in?
It was actually at the Rand Graduate School, which is part of the Rand Corporation, a famous old think tank in Santa Monica, as a matter of fact, right? And I went there. Part of it was because I was at the time older than most PhD students, and I wanted to, maintain the conceit that I was working as opposed to just studying. And so at 31, 32 years old, 33, I was doing work on public policy analysis, which is what I ultimately got my PhD in, with my fields in applied microeconomics and mathematical modeling. And I was doing theater level combat analysis for the Air Force operations, military operations research.
Sorry, what level? What level?
Military. I was doing theater level combat.
Theater level? What does that mean? What does that mean?
I just got too wonky by accident. What that means is I was doing large scale military simulations of different theaters of war.
I see. That's so cool. That's the terminology for that.
Yeah, yeah.
I just learned something new. I love that. I love that. Yeah.
I was doing aircraft survivability using a pretty sophisticated early artificial intelligence modeling.
Wow.
Bunch of mainframes all kind of linked together for large. We were running, 250,000 line Fortran models, et cetera, just to simulate war situations that had never actually been fought. And using pretty sophisticated math to do it. And that was a really big departure for me, obviously, from playing the French horn. But it was part of the cognitive development. The great thing, those who are listening to us, the great thing about doing a PhD in any topic is because you get somewhere between 4 and 6 years of an apprenticeship in hard thinking. And, there's this whole literature, the literature on the 10,000 hours, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the things that's actually true, I don't believe that we should specialize too much. I believe we should be able to do lots of things in life. But I do believe you have to do something, get a lot of reps to get good at it. And that also includes thinking. Most people don't actually have time to think. They actually don't think very much. They kind of do, go all day. And when you do a PhD in, everything from literary criticism to military operations research or whatever you're studying, you're going to have years to just smash your brain against a wall over and over and over again. And the most important intellectual thing that ever happened to me was having all those years to learn how to think and learn how to learn. I'm just a much linear thinker than I was when I was in the music business. And I'm persuaded I could have a PhD in almost any topic and it would have largely given me the same benefit because of the time.
Yeah. And a lot of journalists say they feel like they get a lot of mini PhDs, doing the work that they do.
There's no such thing as a problem, because you basically small periods of time they're isolated, don't add up to one long period of time. It's the same thing that people who are meditators understand. That, I've been somebody who's been deeply involved in contemplative practices for, most of my adult life. And one of the things every day, for example, every day for, 25 or 30 minutes at the end of the day with my wife, we pray and meditate together. And And it's super important for my equilibrium and for my relationships and everything else, but it's nothing compared to the large scale, long term, multi-day silent retreats. And it's because the 25 minutes doesn't scale when you summit. You actually have to, you have to sit in silent meditation. You have to be quiet for day after day after day. And if you want to think a lot, you know, thinking in many PhDs is not the same thing as working for several years. That's like a multi-year cognitive retreat.
I mean, are you concerned about the cynicism towards experts that seems to be really accelerating to the extent to which, you know, people think they have the truth, and that if someone comes in who did a whole PhD on the topic, I feel like people are not taking those individuals seriously as much as they used to.
Yeah, well, I my view is that they actually never took them seriously.
Good point.
I think that there's always been a lot of, I think there's a lot, and for two reasons. One is that one of the great charms of the United States is that we don't trust experts. We don't trust elites. We don't trust them. And the reason is because, you know, when the Kaufmans came to the United States, they were not landed gentry. You know, they were probably running from some godforsaken shtetl in you know, Eastern Europe or something, right?
Actually, my grandma escaped the pogroms in Russia.
So there you go. Yeah. You know, and she was, you know, basically everybody listening to us, almost everybody listening to us, I'm going to assume, descends from ambitious riffraff, you know, where they were running away from people who had all the power, from the experts, from the elites, from the people who had the goods, coming to the United States where they could build it themselves, notwithstanding the fact that they were nobodies. Well, when we're a country of nobodies and the descendants of nobodies, we have a kind of a healthy suspicion of the people of the somebodies. And so, you know, you and I have been really, really fortunate, and we've had a lot of privilege to be able to develop our intellect and to get some expertise. You know, the guys with the PhDs, which I just rhapsodized about the PhD, but I understand that there, you can get a lot of conceit with that as well. And so I'm not a populist, but I sort of admire the healthy suspicion and skepticism that people have of you know, people like you and me too.
I love the skepticism until it's directed at me, and then I don't love it.
I know. And it's funny.
I want people to respect me.
it's it's funny because you know, on one side of my family, you know, practically nobody went to college, and on the other side, and I'm a third generation a college professor.
Yeah.
So on one side, everybody.
Harvard, no less. Come on. Come on.
Fair Harvard. I know. It's actually pretty interesting, Scott, because I remember, you know, I teach happiness at the Harvard Business School.
Yes.
And the first thing that I tell them when I get in there is that the paradox of the Harvard Business School is that if you don't get in, you're not happy. And if you do get in, you're not happy. So, and I know that because I didn't get in when I was actually trying to get into graduate school. I got my bachelor's degree by correspondence, because I was on the road as a musician. And it turns out that Harvard is not looking for graduate students who are 30-year-old French horn playing dropouts with correspondence degrees. Weird, right? I mean, it turns out that's not their core demographic. So I got rejected in like 2 weeks. I remember feeling just crushed. Mm. Like, I have no future. It's not going to be any good. And then I get to the weird things, you know, life, you never know what it's going to have in store for you. I wind up as a professor at Harvard, and I'm looking at the data on people who graduated with their MBAs 10 years ago, and they're really dissatisfied. A lot of them, not all of them, many of them are very happy, but many of them are dissatisfied with the worldly rewards that they were promised and in their lives. And it basically shows that getting in or not getting into Harvard is not the secret to happiness or unhappiness. It lies within each of us. Hence the importance of the psychology podcast.
Well, thank you. And your podcast, if I dare say, on happiness. I would like to ask you how your approach to the, quote, science happiness is different from others who are studying happiness, because I feel like you have some unique spins on this topic.
There are a couple of ways that my approach differs from many others. And one of the great things about the science of happiness and all the many experts that are out there is that there's a multiplicity of approaches, all the good ones of which actually rely on empirical social sciences. In other words, we're looking for data that are collected appropriately, and we're looking at statistical methods and experimental approaches that are good. And we're actually trying to get as close as we can to the truth as far as we, so everybody believes in that. But they're, one of the biggest differences that in the schools that are forming is that there's the school that basically has as its root the world of psychotherapy. a psychoanalysis, actually. And those that actually think of happiness as coming out of the psychoanalytic approach of Freud and Jung and the different Viennese schools, their basic raison d'etre, their basic objective is to make pain go away, is to make suffering go away, to make unhappiness go away. And so why would you study happiness? Because life is hard and because people are suffering, and happiness means crowding out the unhappiness that people feel. That's one approach. Another approach is not actually starting from the rationalist or humanist psychoanalysis world. It actually starts from the world of philosophy, of theology, of spirituality. And you know, that's an approach that basically says, guess what? Unhappiness is part of happiness, because the macronutrients of the subjective well-being meal, kind of like the protein, fat, and carbohydrates, are actually enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose. Those are the three macronutrients of happiness. And guess what? Purpose, meaning in life, requires pain. It requires suffering. It requires challenges. It requires unhappiness.
What if my purpose in life is to eat chocolate?
That can't be your purpose in life. That's enjoyment.
That's
the different macronutrients.
Okay.
You were thinking your carbohydrates were actually proteins, and that's the problem.
Who are you to tell me what my purpose in life is?
And so that's those are I would say that those are really the two big schools. And then the psychoanalytic approach, it basically says that there are all different ways that people can you find the source of suffering and try to eliminate it. Let's find out the nature of what it means to be alive approach, which is that second approach. What's the nature of human life, the experience of human life? That basically comes down to what you might think of as you know, the pillars of happiness, which are experiential pillars of happiness. And there are really only four, according to the literature: faith, family, friendship, and work that has meaning, that's generative, which is to say where you earn your success and where you serve other people. And, you know, so I really subscribe to the second school, the school of the nature of human life. I don't want to suffer needlessly, but I have to suffer. And every single one of us has to understand that your suffering is really a sacred thing. It makes you who you are. It makes you fully alive. Now, it can be too much. It can be too much. It can be overwhelming. It can be post-traumatic stress can overtake post-traumatic growth. There's all kinds of cases in which that's the case. But if we actually want to anesthetize ourselves from suffering per se, we're going to have big problems in the business of being fully alive. And, you know, that's the adventure is really where it comes from. So, and it comes down to that approach. The school that I subscribe to is, you know, it's kind of summed up by George Valiant.
Famous
psychiatrist here at Harvard who wrote many best-selling books, but also he ran the Harvard Study of Adult Development, an 80-year longitudinal study of people's lives. And he said, basically, the whole study can be boiled down to five words. Happiness is love, full stop. And so that's it. There's one is Freud and the other is, you know, love.
Well, we're done today. Nice to have you on the psychology podcast.
Delighted to be with you, Scott.
It's done. No, you know, I just adored your conversation with your most recent conversation with the Dalai Lama. I know you've had multiple conversations, but I love how you talk about how happiness, connection, and the fear of being unneeded lies behind much of our feelings of anxiety and existential loneliness.
Right.
It's an interesting kind of inversion, you know, it's the opposite end of what we often talk about, the need to matter. You know, people right. really want to feel like they matter. But I think it's an interesting spin on it where you talk about kind of the fear of being unneeded, kind of like its opposite pole.
Yeah. So, and there's actually a couple of different things nested in that, to begin with. So we think about what is dignity? And, you know, almost everybody in the West would agree with the following statement. And there's a reason it's in the West. I'll say in a second, I'm not being xenophobic here, that there's a radical equality of human dignity. People are radically equal. It's just as human beings walking on the planet. Most everybody listening to us, especially from the West, would agree with that. But it's actually really important because that actually comes from an ancient concept, a Judeo-Christian concept, but from the Jewish notion that people are descended in the likeness of God, and that God is worthy of respect, and so therefore people are inherently worthy of respect. Dignity is to be worthy of respect. Now, that's not true in every culture and every tradition. That is certainly not true in the cultures that say that people are not made in God's image. That doesn't necessarily descend. It's not sort of an opinion on the genome necessarily. You know, different people disagree with that. You find different people around the world. It's like, no, people don't have inherent human dignity. You got to earn it. And I'm like, no, you don't have to earn it. The problem is, depending on no matter which school you're from, East or West, we can all agree that not everybody has an equal sense of their dignity. To not sense your dignity is the essence of despair. And despair comes, or dignity is absent when you are a liability, when you're not an asset. To be needed is to be an asset to develop. To be unneeded, to be unnecessary, to be expendable is to be a liability to manage. Mm. Think about it within the case of our own children. You know, I got three kids. I thought three adult kids. And I would never have brought up my kids feel like they're liabilities that I'm managing. You know, you get liabilities off the bottom line of your balance sheet as a company.
Right.
You manage them away as soon as you can. Assets can be tremendously expensive, but you develop them even if you're losing money on them. And that's how my kids are assets. I mean, they were resource eaters, man. I mean, you should have seen what college bills looked like. It was insanity. But that's because they were huge. They were moral. They were psychological. They were emotional assets. They were assets to the world and assets to my family. And they knew it. And that was the empowerment. That was the dignity that actually came. That's super important for everybody. And one of the big things that we get wrong in our society today, I believe, is that we treat some people like assets to develop and certain people like liabilities to manage. We treat poor people in this country like liabilities to manage, the way that we run our welfare system, the way that we many times that we run our schools. And, you know, that's discrimination against poor people. And I think it's really morally impermissible.
Well, I agree. I'm trying to think of it within the framework of some personality research I've done, because people differ in their need to matter. And I've studied the concept pathological altruism, where people have an extreme need to matter. And I'm wondering to what extent should we, there's two sides of this coin. So there's absolutely, I agree with you that we should be treating people as assets, be treating each individual with dignity. That's part of my light triad concept. From within, it seems the most psychologically healthy thing is not to require your self-esteem to be dependent on the extent to which you perceive that you matter in the world. There should be some sort of internal stable acceptance of, well, I have dignity just by my, you know, being a human, you know? So how do you sort of, do you see what I'm saying? Like, how do you kind of manage that? Yeah,
totally. And so I think that actually gets into a slightly different dimension. One thing is to be needed by other people. The other thing is to objectify yourself such that you're unreplaceable. You know, this is really different, right? I mean, you can imagine that you're running a company, you're the CEO of a company, because each one is the CEO of our lives, right? Yep. I mean, each one of us is living the startup life. And then you have an employee in your company. You have somebody who's really going to help you. That person can be organically really, really, really needed, right? And so you want to develop that person because they're so necessary. Or that person can be so kind of devious and malfeasant that they can make themselves unreplaceable to you. And we see this in companies all the time, the sort of sycophants and yes men that are following the CEO around, creating problems and then being mysteriously the only person who can clean them up. That's a very different kind of phenomenon. Now, so the balance that's actually really important, I think, for achieving dignity and in turn happiness, is to be at once necessary, needed, therefore an asset in other people's lives, but at the same time, profoundly useless. And this is a different and competing concept that actually comes from Aristotle's notion of complete and incomplete activities, or telic and atelic activities and experiences. So he talks an awful lot about, you know, what it means to be a true or a perfect friend. That's not somebody that you're going to objectify. You don't have a friendship with them because you want to buy something or sell something to them. And it's not just because you admire the person. It's because you have a shared love. You have a shared set of values. And it's inherently, and it's a completely satisfying experience just to hang out with somebody. It's useless.
Yeah.
And so that's really, really important. One of the things that I often write about is the importance of having useless friends and having people who consider you to be useless. in this profound way. it sounds terrible, right?
No, it sounds one. Because I know exactly what you mean by that. Can I link it to my favorite psychologist, Abraham Maslow's notion of love for the being of others. I'm a huge promoter of this.
You're exactly right. Maslow has exactly this perfect balance between at once being needed and being useless.
He calls it unneeding love, and he distinguishes that from needing love.
Exactly right. So it takes a lot of sort of thought and contemplation to net this out, to say at once I need to be needed and at the same time I need to be useless, because those two ideas are actually profoundly compatible with each other.
Oh yeah.
And so easy to misunderstand, it's so easy to misuse, it's so easy to become neurotic about it, such that we become unreplaceable, such that we become artificially useful. And in that way, we can't experience the love that comes from complete friendships. And at the same time, we don't get the dignity of feeling like we're needed cosmically in some really important way. I mean, we need useless things.
I couldn't agree more. I want more useless friends. Will you be my useless friend, Arthur?
I would be delighted to be your useless friend. I'm useful to you right now on your podcast, but but we share values, and that's actually the basis of useless friendship.
Exactly. Like, a useless friend to me conjures up a friend that we can just like watch a sunset together, do some edibles, like chill on the beach, discuss philosophy, discuss free will. And there's nothing we're trying to get out of each other, you know?
Yeah, no, that's right. And that's one of the reasons. It's actually pretty interesting. You know this literature better than I do, but about mature friendships. So people in their 50s and 60s and 70s, that men tend to have useless friendships on the basis of a shared useless activity. So it's like, we're super into baseball. Baseball is the most useless thing ever. And that's the reason it creates so much joy in people's lives, because it's a complete activity. An incomplete activity is one that's instrumental to some greater end. And a complete activity is basically you consume it, and it is the meal and the nutrition in itself. That's useless in this really profound and wonderful way. And so men tend to consume useless things together as the basis of their useless friendship, whereas women, especially in their 50s and 60s, they tend to have relationships that are useless, but based on a common understanding of feelings. They discuss intimate things. Now, this is important. It's an important distinction, because the friendship between women under those circumstances tends to be more enduring, and it tends to be stronger than it is. You know, it's like if all Scott and I have in common is like love for the Red Sox, that's, you know, it might endure. On the other hand, you know, it might only endure as long as the Sox have a good season, which you never know.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. Well, so with this, keeping on the notion of love, I'm really curious why you precisely define fear as the opposite of love.
So fear is, I say this with appropriate humility, with a guy with a union card in social psychology and emotion specialist.
Please don't be insecure. Yeah.
I'm an economist, so we're the most imperialist of all the social scientists, but it doesn't mean we know the most. And fear as a philosophical matter, and if you go back to Lao Tzu or, you know, the Apostle John or, you know, any of the, you know, Aristotle for that matter, fear is the ultimate negative emotion. And that's actually a physiological truth as well. So the amygdala, which governs fear, gives us the responses of fight, flight, or freeze, is more potent than any other part of the limbic system. Fear will crowd out all emotions, positive or negative. So the negative emotions are generally classified as sadness, fear, anger, or disgust. And the positive emotions, joy, love, and some people put in interest, which I think is great, because, you know, being interested is so intensely satisfying. But of those seven emotions, the most powerful is fear, because as an evolutionary matter, fear has to be able to crowd out everything. You got to clear the decks with fear, because if there's a saber-toothed tiger around, you need to not be enjoying the smell of those beautiful flowers or those tasty berries or anything else. And so the amygdala will say, ding, 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 ding. It's like a fire alarm. It will send off a signal through your hypothalamus to signal to your pituitary gland thus to your adrenal glands to send out adrenaline and cortisol and put your whole system on high alert. Now, that's an important thing, because what that means is that it's the predominant emotion. And it's and you can easily see why philosophers and later psychologists would say it's the ultimate negative emotion. It's good for you, but it's a negative emotion nonetheless. And so therefore, its opposite has to be the ultimate positive emotion, which is love. Mm. Now, that's actually coherent philosophically, because you find that what people typically will say, which is hate is the opposite of love. Hate is downstream from fear in almost every case. Pride is downstream from fear. Envy is downstream from fear. All of these things are fundamentally fear-based emotions. You know, you don't hate something, really, really hate something that's not a threat. You know, if it's not a threat to you, it's actually not worth hating. And a threat is stimulating the amygdala. It's stimulating the fear response. It's you're getting the stress hormones. So both physiologically and psychologically and philosophically, we find that the ultimate negative emotion is fear, and that puts it 180 degrees away from love.
Yeah, I'm continually amazed how so many things, so many phenomena can be reduced to the avoidance approach distinction in psychology.
Yeah. No, it's amazing. It's actually one of those fundamental ideas that winds up organizing most of the rest.
I mean, yeah, like everything like ultimately reduced to like, are you avoiding it or are you engaging in it, you know?
And that's right. Yeah. Love is an engaging emotion and yes. Fear is an avoidant emotion. So that's another way of organizing this whole set of ideas. But you know, and then there actually are implications of this for all of our lives. You know, and again, because the psychology podcast, which is understand the science, then work on the applications. And so the application of this is, you know, when you're suffering from something negative, one of the best ways to deal with it is not taking it on its face, but looking for its opposite and cultivating that. Mm. Right. And so basically, if you're engaged in all kinds of avoidant behavior, one of the best ways of coping with this in therapy is to actually find something in which you can engage, because that induces this cognitive dissonance that you don't avoid everything. And then you know, it changes your approach to life. It's behavioral matter. Well, the same thing is true with fear. When people come to me, my students, for example, they'll say they're really afraid of something. And what I'll look for is ways that they can love more, that they can surround their lives more in love, which thus neutralizes fear. Perfect love drives out fear, according to the Apostle John. And you know, philosophers have said this in non-religious contexts forever. And at the same time, if people will say to me, I don't have enough love in my life, I'll say, let's examine your fear. Because you know, the fact that they have a lack of love probably means they have an excess of fear. So let's not look at the love directly. Let's look at the fear and find out if there's something that we can do to treat the level of fear in their lives. And in so doing, they can create more space for love.
I love that. But can I ask you a cheeky follow-up question?
Yeah. My favorite kind.
Can't you have too much love, which is really fear?
Tell me, give me an example.
Do you know how there are people that like, that's all they ever, every third world is like, we need love, we just need love, we love, love, I love, 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 love. And they won't shut up about loving, and they're obsessed with it. They're obsessed with the word love. Like, it's like the only thing they ever think or talk about. And it's like, that's the only thing we ever should have in the world. And at the slightest sense that like, something like a conversation makes someone feel uncomfortable, they're like, we just need more love. Stop the conversation. Yeah. We need love. I mean, isn't there a point at which that's actually because the person has fear? Like they're using love as a way to like cover up
fear. Yeah, for sure. It's actually not love too. I mean, Paul Bloom,
right? Fair enough.
Yale, he has this great book called Against Empathy.
Oh yeah,
it's a fantastic book.
He's my homeboy. And Paul Bloom's my homeboy.
He's great. Yeah, it's a fabulous book because you know it's on the cover. It's a great cover too. It's a picture of a heart frozen inside an ice cube. You know, and Against Empathy. But it's actually the wrong image, because what he argues for is compassion.
And rational compassion.
Yeah, he makes the distinction between compassion and empathy. And what you find is that people who are excessively empathetic, they tend to be insufficiently compassionate. Why? Because empathy is easy. Anytime there's any conflict, if you say you need more love, you're twisting the concept of love away from doing hard things. What is love? According to St. Thomas Aquinas, to love is to will the good of the other. You know, there's nothing about feelings and love. Love is a commitment. love is a commitment to act in a particular way, notwithstanding your feelings. If you truly love somebody, and you know, this is the secret to a happy marriage. I've been married for 30 years.
Wow.
The secret to a happy marriage is not feelings. It's not feelings. It's commitment. It's action. It's work. Love is work. Love is the greatest work. It's the most satisfying work. But the problem that we have in our modern society, among others, is that we've reduced love to a feeling. And that's the reason that marriages don't last, because we have unrealistic expectations. It's the reason that we have a public policy system that's excessively empathetic and insufficiently compassionate with people, that treats adults like children, that reduces them to liabilities in our society, because empathy is easy. And anytime there's any conflict, you say, well, we just need more love. That's exactly the problem that we're talking about. That is, anybody who says that has reduced love to a feeling, thus devalued it by understanding it incorrectly.
Cool. Thank you so much for getting my question. Like, I feel like you immediately got what I was getting at.
And oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No, totally. Yeah. It's a great question. It's an important question. It's something we all need to grapple with, because we all have a tendency to do just that.
Yeah. When we're feeling fear. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes we won't even speak our mind because we're so afraid of not being loved by the other person, you know?
Oh, yeah. No, everybody does that. And it's particularly easy to do given the current cultural currents that we see in society today, where people wield power by willfully misinterpreting or taking the worst possible spin on you know, it's the bullying tactics of the current moment of extremism are such that everybody, right and left, is trying to cancel everybody else. And so everybody's walking on eggshells all the time. You can't say what you think because people who bear you ill will are looking for an opportunity to not give you the benefit of the doubt. Now, everybody who's listening to this is thinking about either one side or the other.
Oh, yeah.
The way to combat that is to look on your own side. So if you're a conservative, don't only be worried about cancel culture on campuses. Be worried about the extent to which you actually get no quarter. You give no quarter on your own political side when somebody doesn't toe the line.
Well, let's talk about conservatives. Can we talk about conservatives?
We can.
Because you have a very interesting take, because some people will, you know, you have like, was it bleeding heart liberals? Is that the idea? Can't you have bleeding heart conservatives?
Yeah, I guess I am one, I suppose.
You are.
It's fair to say. If I believe that happiness is love, full stop. And furthermore, the public policy issue literally that I care about the most is poverty. But I actually take what are traditionally thought of as conservative approaches. It doesn't really matter if they are. I mean, I believe that the free enterprise system is the greatest system in the history of humanity for pulling people out of poverty. Mm. I don't believe that because I want it to be true. I believe that because I've been looking at the data, and we have pulled 2 billion people out of poverty largely through globalization and free trade, property rights, the rule of law, and the culture of entrepreneurship since 1970. You know, that has changed the world. It's changed my life, actually, that basic truth. And, you know, these are my sisters and brothers, and I want the next 2 billion to be pulled out of poverty. So that kind of defines the contours traditionally of what you'd be thought of as politically. You know, it's like, oh, that's a conservative guy. But no, the reason I think those things is not because I care about capitalism, not because I care about money. It's because I believe that people should be able to build their lives like I've been able to build my life, because I want to be a warrior for human dignity. So it's complicated, right?
It's complicated, but but you're adding that level of nuance that I don't see that prevalent in these kinds of discussions.
Yeah, it turns out that political discussions in America, they're not very nuanced.
I mean, if the left and the right cancel each other, will there be a center that there'll just be a center that exists?
Yeah, that's called ordinary everyday life. And that's where most people exist in the better part of their lives. People have political opinions, but for most sentient humans, their politics are not the most important part of their lives. The problem is that politics has taken on an outsized role in the American discourse. And it's been contemporaneous with the retreat of traditional religion. You know, people need moral camps, they need tribes that they can belong to. And you know, as the percentage of Americans under 30 who say they have no religious affiliation has gone from 3% to 30% over the last 2 generations, you're going to see more and more young people who affiliate and who expressively use a framework of moral ideas to say I attach themselves to. And it's not going to be necessarily the United Methodist Church. It might be the American Democratic Party. instead. You know, people need that fundamentally. But then there's also been this political entertainment complex, largely perpetrated by social media and the cable news networks. And what they have done is they've made it really, really easy for people to exist in filter bubbles and caricature the other side. When they get out of those, you know, when they're actually trying to deal with their neighbors and friends at Thanksgiving dinner and at the soccer games and at the choir practices, if they still go to choir practices, that, you know, politics for most Americans is not the salient feature of their lives. And I think that's really, really good. You know, I'll read these surveys that, you know, written by guys like you and me that are extremely, you know, sad about the fact that the average American can't name both her senators. And I'm like, right on, man. That's exactly the country I want to live in. It's not that I want people who are apathetic, but I want people who are able to live their lives and live in such a stable, strong, upwardly mobile, charitable, and rich country that they don't have to be thinking all the time, okay, who's my senator? Who's going to come and get my stuff?
Right.
God bless America. That's all I can say.
I hear you. I mean, there are a lot of people in this country right now that don't love America. I mean, I hear the conversations on Clubhouse and things. They wouldn't say God bless America. They say, what has America done for me? You know,
right.
But and you're certainly saying that you want us to move in the direction where everyone will say God bless America. Yeah.
Well, I want everybody to say that they love America. I mean, I don't necessarily want people.
I didn't phrase that properly. I mean, you're not like a dictator. That. You're not a dictator. No, I know. You know, yeah. I didn't. And, you know what I mean?
No, but and more to the point, to be quite literal about it, I literally believe in God. You know, I'm a traditionally religious person, but I'm so happy to live in a country where not everybody is. Mm-hmm. I want everybody to share faith because it's such a source of joy. And I think that my faith is correct. So I would, you know, recommend it to anybody for sure. But I want to live in a country where we all don't think alike. I want to live in a family where we all don't think alike. You know, in the Proverbs, they say that iron sharpens iron. That's such a source of joy. And this gets back to the original premise of your question, which is that we're not getting happiness from that. And we really should. We should be, you know, down on our knees with gratitude that we live in a country where you can disagree politically, where you can, you know, write something on the internet saying that the president of the United States is a criminal and a jerk, and there's no knock in the night and no jackbooted thug. But instead, we're such ingrates that we're saying all the time that this is a terrible, terrible country. Isn't it horrible? We're as bad as Nazi Germany. It's just, you know, as Stalinist Russia, it's nuts. It's nuts what we're doing. It's an ingratitude. And ingratitude is a product of the lack of love. And that comes down to too much fear. And that's where we started.
Yeah, there are multiple things there I want to zoom in on. It's so interesting. This is such an interesting conversation. So I'm really curious to hear more how your religion and spirituality impacts your approach to human happiness in contrast to like the rationalist humanist approach, for instance.
Well, so we talked a little bit ago about the fact that there are two basic strands of happiness researchers, one that's on the rationalist humanist psychoanalytic approach and the other that's on the spiritualist philosophical love-based approach. And there's some people who are in the middle who actually don't come down in either. I mean, I don't mean to, it's kind of an artificial distinction, but if there is a distinction, I'm firmly in the second camp. And part of this is just because I've made a decision in my life, like every love-based decision, like the decision to be a husband to my wife. And with the, my ambition is that she is the last person I see as I take my dying breath. That's my ambition. That's a decision. Right. That's not it has feelings attached to it, but those are adjunct feelings. And the same thing is true with the decision that I've made about what I think is the right approach to my life, which is to embrace tenets of spirituality, to put them within a framework that's well established by people who are more sophisticated, smarter than me in traditions that have gone back thousands of years. And that I understand that there are certain things that I can't know. I'm an empirical social scientist. And these are the mystery of faith, which is taking things where that are non-testable hypotheses on the basis of that faith, but understanding that doing so is actually a very rational thing to do, and it makes my life that much better, and that sharing it with others can make their life that much better as well. And also it illuminates numerous sources of mysteries in life. It resolves all kinds of Gordian knots that are both cognitive and philosophical. They're things that also that I realize that I don't have to solve all the time. I don't have to be tortured by constantly. And it gives me a tremendous source of consolation. So I love it. It's just the happiest adventure in my life is my spiritual life.
I really appreciate you sharing that viewpoint. I consider myself more spiritual than religious, but I imagine we both are united in seeking very similar self-transcendent experiences.
That's right. And, you know, some people believe, you know, people I've heard on your show, as a matter of fact, believe that transcendent experiences are nothing more than kind of random synaptic signals in the brain, that everything is encompassed by the radical and material.
You really listen to my podcast. I'm impressed.
I actually do. Actually, the podcast is a great podcast. And I learn a lot from it. Yeah. And, you know, that's important because, you know, that materialistic view is utterly at odds with this concept that there very well might be a cosmic consciousness that exists before us and after us, and that we're part of, which is, I think that's the most plausible view. I mean, we don't know, but, you know, and I know that you share the view that free will can exist, and free will can only exist when there's an exogenous consciousness. I mean, it really can't exist if consciousness is nothing more than a part of the brain, right?
Yeah, I'm not quite a dualist, but I think there's, you know, all the evidence and my own intuitions are pointing to this idea that we're all part of one whole of some sort. This, like you said, cosmic consciousness, or there's something there that people can witness under certain conditions, such as LSD. but the certain conditions
or
where
meditation.
Yes, there's a lot of, we call them spiritual practices, and the research is so exciting in that area, showing how these spiritual practices, if we can somehow reduce that separation between self and world, neurologically through our own ego, various practices, it all arrives to the same conclusion, you know, this oneness.
That's right. Yeah. And it sews up so many age-old mysteries. You know, it's you know, we always say, you know, there's that Zen question, that paradox, that the question that the master will ask the novice monk, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And that, you know, it's like one of these, it's almost a joke, right? It's like in one of these unanswerable Buddhist questions. It turns out it's not a question, it's the answer to a question. You know, the sound of one hand clapping is your individuality and your separation as an entity from the whole. It is an illusion. It's a pantomime. It doesn't actually exist. So, you know, the Buddhist masters, you know, the Dalai Lama explained this to me, that this concept that when you feel that you're isolated, that you're an isolated individual, that your consciousness is nothing more than a vestige of your physical brain, and that you exist out there as a unitary entity, that is an illusion. And that illusion is this radical individuality can be resolved by seeing yourself as, using a different metaphor, you know, an individual tree, for example. An aspen tree is just one shoot off the same root system. It's one entity, but it looks like an individual. So to say, what is my individual nature? What is Scott's individual nature? It is the same thing as the sound of one hand clapping. It looks like a thing.
Excuse me.
It's not a thing.
Excuse me. Speak for your damn self. I'm joking. Yeah. No, look, you're saying some really, really cool things. And, you know, when we talk about self-transcendent experiences that we can all rally around, you see, I think art and creativity has a lot of potential to unify the species, you know, right, in lots of ways. Can you share some of your thoughts on how creativity, art, and music can contribute to our sense of well-being and happiness?
Yeah, I think about that a lot because of my background in the arts. My mother was a painter, and we have, you know, we're all basically artists and academics and in my family. And almost everything that I study now as a social scientist stems from observations and questions that I had when I was in the arts. And one of the things that I find is that when I have I come to a particular conclusion on the basis of data analysis and research, that I can find these fundamental truths embedded in the work of the greatest artists in the world. I actually have a series of videos that I've done called The Art of Happiness. Nice. That looks at these really big ideas in the search for happiness, and finds their metaphors in the work and lives of artists. And in point of fact, I actually became a social scientist because of the world's greatest composer, When I was a kid, working as a professional musician, my favorite composer was Johann Sebastian Bach. And there's nothing extraordinary about that. I mean, almost everybody knows who Bach is. And Bach is half of the world's favorite composer. But the interesting thing about Bach is not the fact that he was just a great and fertile and productive composer and productive person, by the way. He had 20 kids. That's pretty productive. The interesting thing about Bach was his philosophy of his work. And I remember reading this quote near the end of his life and, surrounded by his kids and grandkids and surrounded by love. And he was a very religious guy and deep, deep, deep Christian. And he was asked by a biographer, Herr Bach, why do you write music? It's weird because, all of us who have been able to do something with our lives and achieve some things and some success, people always ask you, Scott, what do you do when they meet you? But they never ask you, why do you do what you do? And you need an answer. You morally need an answer. And Bach's answer was immediate. Apparently, he said immediately to the person who's interviewing him in about 1749 or something when this happened. He said, the aim and final end of all music is nothing less than the glorification of God and the refreshment of the soul.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know. And so for people who are not religious, don't be distracted by that. He said, the point of your work is sanctified service. That's the point of your work. And I heard that. I was still in the music business. I'm like, can I say that? I'm out every night on stage. I don't feel like I'm refreshing souls. And I don't feel like I'm glorifying God. And I literally went in a vision quest to find that what I could do professionally. So I could.
You did the ayahuasca?
I wasn't using the hallucinogens, but I didn't have an ayahuasca experience. But through my meditation and my prayer, through the search for cosmic truth, was so I could find my answer to Bach's question. So I could actually find I became literally, talk about from the sublime to the dismal. Mm. I became a social scientist because I felt like I could refresh souls and glorify God. And Scott, I feel like I'm doing it right now. I mean, it's unbelievable to me. I mean, I'm so happy, not all the time. I'm not, a particularly happy person. I'm so happy to be able to do something. If somebody's listening to us right now, they're like, those are good ideas. Those are things I want to take on board. Those are life-enriching ideas. These are ways that I can actually love a little bit more than in some weird little way, I've composed a kind of a little Bach cantata. And I got it because of Bach's why, not because of Bach's what. That's an answer to your question about how the creativity informs the science.
Well, I love it. I feel like that you just explained why I do everything I do. Yeah. Well, 90% of everything I do. There's always that 10%. You're like, what the fuck was I thinking?
I know. But the other 10% is like paying the rent.
Yeah. Well, we're still human at the end of the day, but, I love that, my intentional purpose that explains why I do that. Love it. Love it. Love it. Can you, kind of ending this interview today, can you tell me about your upcoming book on strategies for getting happier as we age? Because you make a very interesting point. You say that as we get older, our sense of attachment to our achievements makes us more susceptible to noticing our long-term decline. Wow. That's really profound.
Well, so what happened was I started a personal research project to understand how I wanted to design the second half of my life, because I realized there's not very much stuff out there for that. I teach leadership and happiness at Harvard Business School to talk about people who are launching their careers on how they can use the science of happiness. But there's very little. And you're 20 years younger than I am. But you're going to get where I am, and you're going to need, everybody your age is going to need something that's based on the science, based on truth and based on philosophy and based on wisdom to talk about how after you're 50 years old, you can design your life where the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune are not, deciding whether or not you're going to retire happy and go to the grave a happier man than when you were younger. And you shouldn't have to leave it up to chance. There's got to be some signposts. I had some very profound experiences with older people when I was about the age of 50 that suggested that if you leave it up to chance, some really bad things can happen. You find that there's certain dynamics that are really, really solid earlier in life. You find that people, generally speaking, from the early 20s until the early 50s, they gradually decline in happiness, not profoundly. And then in the early 50s to about 70, most people increased dramatically in their happiness. And those are strong empirical tendencies. But after 70 or so, people break up into two big groups. Half get happier and half get sadder as they get older. Now, the group that gets sadder, here's the weird thing they have in common. They tend to be the strivers and the high achievers. That's the paradox of it. And that's the thing I kept finding. And so, you know, the work of Charles and Carol Holohan at University of Texas at Austin, who do work on the burden of high achievement. And basically, if you read their work, what it comes down to, at least my reading of their work, is this like law of psycho-professional gravitation. The more you do with your life, the more you know when it's in decline. If you don't do anything, if you don't live up to your potential, you don't have the slightest idea you're in decline because there's no bump that you're coming down from. On the other hand, if you do a lot, I mean, if you're, you know, Scott Barry Kaufman, you've got the most important psychology podcast. Well, sooner or later, this is not going to be the most important podcast. Sooner or later, this is not going to be the thing that you have right now. And you're going to actually suffer more from the loss. This is Kahneman and Tversky. This is prospect theory. And then there's the writ large phenomenon where all the stuff that you can do. I mean, why are you so successful right now? And the answer is that you're cranking on your fluid intelligence, which is your analytic capacity, your ability to solve problems, your ability.
Well, that's going down the hill. That's going down the hill.
It goes in your 40s. You're not 40 yet, are you?
I am.
Okay. You look good with that hair. I could be president of the United States with that hair.
Thank you.
So, but you know, in your 40s, it declines. In your 50s, it's like really getting low. But there's another curve behind it called your crystallized intelligence, which is based on the stock of stuff you know and your ability to use it, not solving new problems, but assembling information by yourself and others from earlier in life. That's wisdom, which is actually a virtue. And so one of the things that I talk about is, you know, when people feel like they're in decline and they're very depressed, those who get worse and worse and worse off after age 70, it's because they regret what they think of as their only success curve. So the key thing is jumping off, you know, Scott Barry Kaufman's success curve onto Arthur Brooks's success curve. You know, one of the greatest things in my life was, I mean, I read my early academic papers from right when I finished my PhD, and I literally can't understand the math anymore of what I was doing. I mean, it's left me behind. I've left myself in the dust, but now I'm teaching, I'm writing, I'm speaking, I'm doing what I'm doing with you, trying to explain things clearly and in a way that people find inspirational. And I'm better at, way better at it. You know that at, you know, Columbia where you teach or Harvard where I teach, the best teaching evaluations are uniformly for professors who are over 70. These are not pity evaluations. It's because they're the best teachers, because that relies on crystallized intelligence. So I talk in the book about how you can jump from your understand your fluid versus your crystallized intelligence curve, get into the liminal space between them, and to get on your crystallized intelligence curve. What are the techniques for doing it? What are the joys of doing it? How do you do it well? I mean, frankly, I think I actually cracked the code to getting old and loving it.
Oh, wow. I can't wait to read this, you know, especially.
My editor says the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
I haven't turned it in yet.
you know, especially as my fluid reasoning is notably declining by the second. I can't wait to read it. By the way, you said my podcast is inevitably not going to be the most important psychology podcast. Do you know something I don't know? What are you talking about, Arthur Brooks? He's like, are you coming for me?
I know. No, it's just the sands of time, my friend.
Arthur's like, it's only a matter of time. You're no longer a top. But no, I'm joking. Look, I love talking to you today. You are such a breath of fresh air in our society that has such polarization, but also such extreme views on things, that doesn't incorporate spirituality into the discussions, doesn't treat people as sacred. I've been arguing we need to start treating people as sacred. I feel like you would agree with that.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate you, Arthur, and wish you well.
Thank you, Scott. Congratulations again on the podcast, and thanks to all the listeners who are, you know, making this the most popular thing, because it should be, because it's high quality and you're doing a great
service. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Also, if you'd prefer a completely ad-free experience and would like early access to new episodes, you can join us at patreon.com/psychpodcast. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Welcome to Season 9 of Next Question with me, Katie Couric. I've got some big news to share with you in our season premiere featuring the one and only Kris Jenner.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That is very, very exciting.
And that's just the beginning. We'll also be joined by podcast hosts Jay Shetty, Hillary Clinton, Renee Fleming, Liz Cheney, and many more. So come on in, take a break from the incessant negativity for a weekly dose of fascinating conversations. Some of them, I promise, will actually put you in a good mood. Listen to Next Question with me, Katie Couric, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
I am so excited about this podcast, The Bright Side. You guys are giving people a chance to shine a light on their lives, shine a light on a little advice that they want to share.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.